Coming up.
Let's get down to brass tacks here, man. How much for the ape?
The moral lives of animals.
I went on down to the Oakland Zoo, and the owl asked for you. The monkey asked, the tiger asked, and the elephant asked me too.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
Do animals ever act for moral reasons?
You ate my homework? I didn't know dogs really did that.
Don't we need to be able to reflect on our moral principles in order to be moral?
Think about it, Smithers. If I came into your house and started sniffing at your crotch and slobbering all over your face, what would you say?
Our guest is Mark Rowland, author of Can Animals Be Moral?
Now that's what I call a dead parrot.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford University, where Ken and I hang out during the week.
Today, the moral lives of animals.
Can non-human animals ever be moral? Can they possess moral virtues like altruism and empathy? Can they act according to ethical principles like fairness and justice?
John, of course not. People like to think such things, but that's just because we have this tendency to project all kinds of human traits onto animals, especially when they're cute. That's just anthropomorphism, and that's what this is.
Well, Ken, before you just dismiss the question, can we at least think about it? I mean, there's lots of reasons for thinking that some mammals, at least, behave relevantly like humans, and that they can feel empathy, loyalty, and grief, even guilt when they know they've been bad. Any cat owner could tell you that animals can be vengeful or spiteful, which is why I have a dog. Dogs, at least, are loyal and have some minimal sense of right and wrong.
I have a dog, too, and I love my dog. And this is what happens. I come home. I go into the library. She's gotten into the trash can again underneath my desk, and the trash is all over the place. I get upset. She looks guilty. She's not looking guilty because she thinks, oh, no, I did wrong again. She just knows I'm upset at her. And you know what? She'll do it again and again and again and again whenever the trash is left out. You call that right and wrong? You call that morality?
No, I call it being stupid. I mean, there's lots of trash cans that have lids that dogs can't get in. Why don't you get one? But back to the point, do you really think people are all that different? When your kid misbehaves or gets caught doing something he's not supposed to be doing, don't you think his guilty expression is just a response to your kidding?
Well, maybe when they're really young and haven't developed their own moral compass, maybe then, as you're suggesting, misbehaving kids are a little like misbehaving pets. But you know, there's a big difference. Kids are in training to become fully autonomous adults capable of reflecting on their desires and their choices and motivations. You know, you're Gretchen, Taffy, they're never going to get there, John, no matter how much we train them. Never.
Says who? That's clearly an empirical question, and there's lots of evidence of animals acting against their own best interests, for example. Monkeys will refuse to accept food for weeks if that involves another monkey getting an electric shock. They'd rather starve than allow another monkey to suffer. If it was a human, we'd call it altruism or fairness. How is that not morality?
Because morality requires that we reflect on principles, that determine how we're going to act. We have to reflect on how to behave in different circumstances. Sure, I grant you, lots of animals have pro-social instincts. But without that capacity for reflection to make judgments about their own and other animals' actions, they're not moral, John.
Spoken like a true philosopher, Ken.
Well, I'm proud to be a true philosopher, and your point is?
You're hyper-rational. You think everyone is just like you, but they're not. Most people just follow their moral instincts, and they don't spend a whole lot of time deliberating about what's right and wrong. They just act without thinking, and that's often just the best thing to do.
Oh, come on. What are you talking about?
Well, imagine you see a toddler wandering out into the street in front of traffic. If you stop and reflect, oh, Would rescuing the toddler be the best thing for humanity in the long run? Would I be acting on a generalizable principle? You're just a big jerk, and the kid may get run over while you're deliberating. A moral person would grab the kid and bring him to safety without a second
thought. Well, I grant you that, and that instinct is important, but unless that instinct is, you know, undergirded by a reflective capacity, it's not morality. It's just instinct.
You're too stuck on this Kantian view of morality. My favorite philosopher, Hume, recognize that being moral is about having the appropriate moral sentiments or feelings.
Look, John, if animals really were capable of morality and immorality, then it would seem to follow that we ought to hold them morally responsible for their actions. We ought to imprison them, punish them, sanction them the way we do humans. That's just absurd, guy.
Well, it sounds absurd to you because you simply refuse to seriously consider the possibility that animals could ever be moral.
Well, look, I am willing to consider it if there are good reasons. And so we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, in search of reasons to believe that animals are sometimes moral. She files this report.
Michael Nichols is editor-at-large for National Geographic. He's been taking photos of elephants in Africa off and on for 20 years.
And I saw things that were just amazing. I saw them caring for the young. I saw siblings caring for smaller siblings. I've seen a matriarch take her family to go for water when she sees a thundercloud. But not only her, she's taken 100 other elephants with her because they trust her because she knows the environment, because she's the oldest. So many circumstances that I've seen with elephants, of them exhibiting behavior that humans kind of associate just for us.
Nichols documents the animals in his book of photographs, Earth to Sky. He remembers one time in Gabon, he came across a pile of elephant bones.
And they were just beautiful. And they were placed all around. And so I said, I'm just going to put a camera here and see what happens. And sure enough, elephants were regularly visiting that with those bones and touching them and feeling of them. And the thinking is that they're thinking about their friend or their ancestor or whoever that family member was.
Another time, Nichols saw two youngish elephants holding vigil beside their mother after she died. He says that's kind of what you'd expect, but then it got more interesting.
Four or five different families of elephants that weren't related to her in a physical sense, they were probably friends, came by and visited the carcass and touched it and, you know, did their smelling thing and then moved on. They didn't vigil. The two kids are the only ones that vigiled.
It doesn't seem to make sense to me that we would be the only species to evolve morality.
Laurel Breitman is an anthropologist and historian of science. She's the author of a book called Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Therapy Show Us the Wildness of Our Own Minds.
The idea of morality is wrapped up in human ideas of right and wrong behavior. But, you know, most groups of animals have shared conceptions of what is right and wrong behavior. You know, if you have multiple dogs in a household and you see, like, the mama dog shut down the puppy for being obnoxious, you know, we might not look at that as exactly moral behavior, but it's like societal correctives, which is what I think moral behavior works as frequently in human societies.
But Breitman says there's a flip side.
My next book is about animal outlaws. I think I spend all my time thinking about animal criminals at this point.
I did witness our lionesses plan an attack on a hyena that they saw.
Photographer Michael Nichols has been filming female lions recently, and he's seen their cruelty up close.
They drug it out of its den, and then she ritually bit and severed its spine, which didn't kill it, and left it there. I was stunned because they killed it in a very different way.
When lions kill for food, Nichols says, they kill fast. These lions left the hyena there to die slowly.
You know, is that immoral? It's certainly strange. But, you know, with lions, we would talk about it, but I don't know if we would make a value judgment about it.
Science historian Laurel Breitman says at least at some point in history, people did make judgments against animals who stepped out of line.
In medieval Europe, there was a phenomenon called the animal trials, and animals were actually brought into court for their sins or their transgressions. If we extend to animals the kind of moral agency that we extend to humans, or at least some humans, do we punish them when they transgress, it's a little bit like the plea of insanity, right? Like you're guilty for your crime only if you can recognize that you're committing a crime.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin. Lots of facts about the morality of animals. I'll look at elephants with a newfound respect and continue my long-held policy of avoiding lions. I'm John Perry. With me is my colleague from Stanford University, Ken Taylor.
Today, we're looking into the moral lives of animals. We're joined now by Mark Rowlands. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Miami. He's author of Can Animals Be Moral? Mark, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
Okay.
Hi, John as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Mark, I'm a little curious about what got you interested in this question. Did you have an especially virtuous pet like I do?
Well, yes, I suppose I did at one point. I first started thinking about this. I became a father at the sort of ripe old age of 44, and various, you know, historical contingencies sort of with that. My new son would be sharing a house with two dogs. One was a wolf dog mix, Nina, who was very nice, but did have a bit of a temper occasionally, and the other was Tess, a wolf dog mix, who was lovely, but did have a very sort of highly developed prey drive. So I was, a little worried about how the new co-sharing arrangements were going to go down. But as it turned out, I needn't have worried at all. You know, I think the sort of crowning realization came when it occurred to me they might be better parents than I was. You know, the sort of crawled on, kneed, dribbled, kicked, the fingers in the eye they received on a sort of almost daily basis, they just shrugged off with a sort of zen-like calm. And then if my son so much as squeaked in the middle of the night, then there'd be two cold noses pressed in my face immediately. Get up, you negligent parent, your son needs you. And I think the sort of seeds of this sort of idea started forming in those sort of sleepless nights of early fatherhood.
But they didn't read to your kid. I'm sure they didn't read to your kid.
No, that's true. But they were old dogs, and he was young when they died. So who knows what might have happened?
So something good came out of the sleepless nights of new fatherhood. That's inspiring. Now, when Ken and I were talking earlier, Ken was claiming, I don't know how sincerely, that he didn't think that animals can be moral, and that was just a result of our projecting our human traits onto them. But now we've heard all this stuff from our roving philosophical reporter about the nobleness of elephants and the baseness of lions. So what do you make of this evidence? And do you have other evidence of animals behaving and morally and having moral feelings?
Yes, there's quite a bit of evidence out there, and cognitive biologists are getting very sort of interested in this kind of stuff. So, there was a famous example of Binti Jua, the gorilla in Brookfield Zoo in Illinois, and I think a four-year-old boy fell into the gorilla enclosure, as they do, you know, and was sort of lying there unconscious, and Binti Jua picked him up and sort of cradled him in her arms for a while, kept the other gorillas away, and eventually took him to the sort of access door where where she handed him over to the keeper. But actually, I mean, this doesn't sound particularly scientifically respectable, but perhaps the biggest repository of apparently moral evidence in animals you can now find on YouTube. I think one of my favorites is there are two dogs on a busy, very busy highway in Chile. And one of the dogs is hit by a car, and the other, at enormous risk to itself, weaves in and out of the traffic. I sort of cringed my way through the video, actually, and eventually manages to pull the injured dog to safety, where eventually, in fact, he survived.
Well, yeah. What do skeptics say about this gorilla and this dog?
I'll tell you what this skeptic wants to ask you about it, Mark. I mean, it's sure there's lots of... I don't think animals are like Descartes, simple automatons. I think they have...
You think Descartes was a simple automaton?
No. I don't think, like Descartes, that animals are simple automatons. But I think they have complex inner lives. I would not deny that. And I think everything that's true about humans has some kind of precursor in at least the higher animals as we move up the phylogenetic hierarchy. I'm sure of that. But just because they have complicated lives doesn't make them morality is this really complicated thing, don't you think? Isn't there some grounds to be skeptical, at least minimal? Would you concede that to me?
Well, there's always grounds to be skeptical, Ken, yes. But, I mean, I think you covered the basic options you covered in your introductory chat. You know, it's Hume or Kant, basically. And if you're a Kantian, then, yeah, you do think that morality is complicated. You have to have the abilities to reflect on your motivations, ask yourself whether these are motivations you should endorse or reject, and then evaluate that your answer by bringing to bear sort of moral principles and so on. You know, so yeah, morality involves quite complex metacognitive abilities in the sort of Kantian vision.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, our guest is Mark Rowlands, author of Can Animals Be Moral?
Does being moral mean that you have to be able to rationally evaluate your desires and motivations? Or could animals be moral even without this capacity?
Animals, morality, and rationality. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thoughtful animals at the zoo. Thoughtful, but are they moral? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about the moral lives of animals.
Our guest is Mark Rowlands from the University of Miami. He's the author of Can Animals Be Moral?
So, Mark, as you know, I'm a bit skeptical. I've got these Kantian leanings. And I don't think that animals, most animals anyway, have the right kind of cognitive mental architecture. I take it you, with John, have a different view about what it takes sort of at the base level to be moral. What is it that you think it takes at the base level to be a moral creature?
Well, the one sentence answer would be a kind of reliable normative sensitivity to certain morally salient features of the environment. So let's switch the focus from animals, because this tends to make people go one way or another. Just imagine we have a human being. We'll call him Mishkin.
Mishkin.
Okay. Let's just, well, for the sake of giving him a name, you know.
Okay.
So Mishkin is a lovely person in some respects. You know, when other people are happy, this makes him happy. When other people are sad or suffering, this makes him sad. You know, so he has a kind of emotional sensitivity to certain features of the environment, which can, you know, which we would say are good or bad making features. And it's no accident that he has this sensitivity. It's a result of some kind of mechanism. We could call it a moral module, if you like. Or mirror neurons would be good candidates for this sort of mechanism. And so the mechanism reliably makes Mishkin respond, you know, with happiness to the happiness of others and with sadness to the suffering of others. I think once you've got that kind of reliable, normatively assessable sensitivity, that is sufficient. That is enough for being what I call a moral subject. I don't think it's enough for being a moral agent. I think part of the task here is to sort of separate the ideas of agency on the one hand and motivation on the other.
So, I mean, I'm not sure Ken disagrees about the empirical facts. Let's assume he doesn't. The skeptic agrees that, he's not just saying that there is no inner life and so forth and so on.
I mean, some kind of skeptic could believe that.
Yeah, some kind of skeptic.
But the Cartesian who thought that animals are just automata.
But Ken said he wasn't a Cartesian in that respect. So we say, well, the behavior is clear. The dog, you know, risked his life to save the other dog and so forth and so on. We say, grant that there are feelings that are at least akin in some way, as far as we know, to the feelings that we have as human beings. And then we say, but is he moral? Now, this sounds like what the great unwashed non-philosophers out there call a merely semantic question. That is, you agree on the facts, you're just arguing about defining morality. What's the interest there?
That's a good question, Mark. What do you think?
Yeah, there are two different issues going on. One is an empirical issue about, do we have enough evidence to attribute moral action or moral emotions to animals? And the other is the conceptual issue. What is required? What is a sufficient condition for something to act morally? And, you know, being a philosopher, I've tended to gravitate towards the second issue, the conceptual issue.
But I guess John's trying to get you to tell our great unwashed person that he referred to, why should I care about this conceptual issue once I grant that animals have a kind of complicated inner life? So there could be an empirical question. Do animals have a complicated enough inner life to even get up to the plate? Right? Yeah, they have complicated inner lives. But then there's another question. Does that inner life constitute a moral agency, moral subjecthood, moral something? I guess John is wondering why once we've got that empirical question, yeah, they've got complex inner lives, why isn't it all just settled? What is the interest in you know what I mean?
Let me put the question this way. Suppose we decide that, well, you know, animals do have these feelings, but that's not enough to be truly moral. But then wouldn't most humans not be truly moral? And if it's not right to punish animals, would it be right to punish humans if they're just behaving instinctively? Does your book settle questions like that?
Well, the issue of punishment is one thing that I think has to be set aside, because I agree that no one wants to go back to medieval animal trials. Right? And I think, you know, at the root of that, that seems like an intuitively good idea not to do that again, right?
So
So at the root of the intuition, I think, is that, you know, whatever else is true of animals, they're not really responsible, certainly not morally responsible for what they do. So then someone might say, well, that settles the issue. If they're not morally responsible, then they cannot act morally. But I think there's quite a bit of room for play here. I mean, I think we can distinguish moral motivation from moral evaluation or responsibility. So it's possible for something to be morally motivated to do something without being morally responsible for it.
So now this goes back to a distinction you mentioned in passing, and you spend a lot of time in your books and some of the papers I've read of yours. You make this distinction. Well, there's a three-part distinction you could make. Lots of people, except really cold-hearted Kantians.
Isn't that redundant?
Lots of people think that you can wrong animals. You can morally wrong them. A creature that can be morally wrong, let's call that creature a moral patient, right? It can be morally harmed. You can be a responsible agent and then morally harm another. That's a moral agent, right? So you have moral agents and moral patients. You think, and I think, I don't know if I've ever found anybody else making distinction. You think there's a third thing. Besides being a moral patient that can be wronged and being a moral agent that can do wrong, there's this other thing, a moral subject.
That's right. Right, yeah.
And what do you mean by a moral subject?
Well, a moral subject is a subject who acts on the basis of moral motivations, but cannot be held responsible for what they do. So it's motivated morally, but not morally responsible.
So give me a reason for believing that there are creatures like that. I mean, an animal is a moral patient, people say, because it can be hurt, and it's always wrong to hurt a sentient feeling being. So it's a moral patient. It has what some people call moral considerability. We are moral agents because we can do the hurting, and we can be held responsible. What is a creature that it can't just be hurt but can do, act, but isn't responsible but is somehow moral? I mean, how can you be a moral actor if you're not morally responsible?
Right. Yeah. There is a difficult issue there, because I mean, there's a well-known slogan comes from Kant. Ought implies can, and so the idea is it makes no sense to say that someone should resist acting in a certain way, should resist a certain motivation, if they have no say in the matter, if they're incapable of resisting it, and so there's a natural line of thought which says, well, this means that you cannot have moral motivation without moral responsibility. That moral motivations are things that you ought to act on if they're good, or you ought to resist if they're bad. But ought implies can, so it makes no sense to say you ought to resist a motivation if you can't. So that's the sort of tricky part, is trying to sort of reaffirm the idea that there could be a moral subject without a moral agent. I think that is, in fact, the case of most animals. It may well be the case of human beings. It all depends what position you adopt on the sort of free will issue. But I think in the case of most animals, we have examples of things which are morally motivated and therefore moral subjects, but are not morally responsible and therefore not moral agents.
Well, let's go back to your child that you had late in life. What'd you say, 44? I think I had two or three grandchildren by then. But anyway, so you've watched this kid grow up for a while now. Now, do you think this kid goes through? Clearly, children start out as being moral patients, right? Whatever one thinks about before they're born, after they're born, they're moral patients. At least even Michael Tooley would say after they're two, they're moral patients, right? Yeah. And when they're adults, they're moral subjects. Agents. And when they're teenagers, they're moral subjects. But is there a period they go through when you think, well, I've trained this kid so that he is a moral agent, that he responds to the moral factors in situations, but he's not really a moral subject. So is that a phase that normal humans go through that animals make it to but don't get beyond?
Except I think you're using his terminology incorrectly.
Backwards.
Moral agents is
backwards,
the full one.
Yeah.
And moral subject is the medium one.
Yeah. Okay, right.
Once your moral agent comes afterwards. I think my children now are 6 and 4, and I'd be quite comfortable with saying that they're moral subjects, but moral agents is a tricky one.
So what will you look for to give them agency? What'll be the evidence that they've passed on to that?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think of agency in terms of sort of various levels of understanding, and I think there are all sorts of types of understanding of moral reasons that adults have that animals don't and that children don't. I mean, we can understand not only that something is right, but we can understand the principles that underlie it, why it's right, and so on. So there are a whole array of moral reasons that we can entertain that animals and children can't.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the moral lives of animals. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Wayne in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Wayne.
Hey. Okay, great. I'd like to start by saying I think, Ken, that you were mistaken when you said that morals are the result of reflection. They are not. They're the result of all sorts of things, but primarily they're the result of instincts. And if I can interject here, I subscribe to Bertrand Russell's thing where he distinguished between morals and ethics, where he said ethics are about fairness and they're based on the golden rule, whereas morals are totally arbitrary. And if you look, for example, at the Bible, it's immoral to wear clothes made of more than one fiber. It's immoral to eat shellfish. It's immoral for men to trim their beards. These things are completely wacko, and they're not the result of reflection. So at any rate, I think really morals. If you just say morals and you don't distinguish between morals and ethics, then morals become such a fuzzy term that it can mean anything, and we could argue ad infinitum and never reach any kind of agreement.
Well, Wayne, thanks for the call. I mean, there's a lot I could say in response and in defense of myself. I will say this: I'm kind of a relativist. But I don't think morals are completely arbitrary. But really what I'm talking about is the capacity for morality. And I don't think that's arbitrary. I think that's built in to the fabric of the human mind. You will never find human collectivities without them throwing at each other moral codes of one sort or another. Whether they all throw the same moral code at each other, that's a different question. And whether there are universals, but the capacity for morality is built into the human mind. And I don't think Mark would disagree with that. He just thinks that capacity for morality gets its foothold in nature earlier than Homo sapiens. Am I right about that, Mark?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that.
So how early? How early? So you and I agree. The capacity for morality is an evolved natural capacity. I think it shows up first in full flower in human beings. How early do you think it shows up?
Well, I think that the case is strongest with the social mammals. So I wouldn't want to commit myself to anything apart from certain social mammals. And I think there are reasons why that's going to be. I mean, the strategy evolution arrived at for keeping these groups of mammals together was instilling various sentiments, the social sentiments, as Darwin called them, in them. And I think once you have the social sentiments, once you have emotions which involve concern for other creatures, then you've got on at least one way of thinking about morality, you have enough for moral motivation at the very least.
So we've got an email here from Isabella in Berkeley that I'm sure reflects the thinking of a lot of our listeners, particularly in Berkeley, which is a very morally refined place. And Isabella says, "You make the assumption that human animals can be moral. There's no doubt that as a species, humans are the least moral. We have unleashed more death, cruelty, and destruction than any other species." So what do you think of that?
Well, moral is a term here which covers both being morally good and being morally bad. So the implication seems to be in the email that we're talking about the morally bad things that human beings do. Mm-hmm. If they can act morally badly, then they're moral creatures, in my sense.
So the question is not whether humans, on balance, have done more good than evil, but whether they're capable of something immoral or not. And I think Isabella seems to clearly agree with you that they're capable of acting in a moral dimension.
Marga from Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marga.
Thank you. My question is partly definition, please, of altruism and empathy in relation to whether animals besides humans can have it. My specific example is I had a therapy pet that went to Kaiser Oakland Oncology, and I taught him some language, like I taught him the word choose. He hated going up in the elevator to the oncology floor. I'd say, choose, you want to do this? He would run into the elevator, his toenails out, fear, hurt, so he could go be with the children. And the nurses laughed, and they said, how come he gets what to do for each child right 100% of the time? So he went through discomfort to make children laugh and be happy. Is that morality when it's for another species? I've seen lots of examples, but that's...
Mark, thanks for the call, Margaret. Mark, why don't you give us a brief answer to that, and we'll discuss it more after the break.
Well, with regard to the sort of definition of altruism, it's tricky because there are at least four different dimensions upon which you can develop that. I mean, I'm not really concerned with the definition of altruism. I'm concerned more with the idea that there can be emotions which have as their content and which take as their object the well-being of another. And I think that is the crux of the issue, really.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Mark Rowlands, author of Can Animals Be Moral?
If animals are moral creatures, then should we hold them morally responsible for their actions? And should we treat them better than we currently do?
The moral status of animals, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Get my dinner from a garbage can.
When a cat struts by, is he being prideful? Does he really have that intellectual capacity? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. That includes your moral intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Mark Rowlands, author of Can Animals Be Moral?
Mark, many people think that animals can be motivated by moral sentiments. Our last caller gave us a nice example of a dog that seems in some broad and undifferentiated sense very altruistic. But suppose we grant that. Suppose we grant that animals are moral subjects in your sense, but fall short of being moral agents. How, if at all, does this change how we should treat them? Does this mean we shouldn't eat the animals that are capable of morality? You're not in favor of medieval dog trials, but where does this lead? What's the practical implication of agreement with you about this threefold distinction and where animals fit in?
Yeah, I think most of the sort of the glaring practical consequences of our treatment of animals are covered by the idea that they're moral patients. I think the idea that they're moral subjects doesn't change behavior as much as sort of attitudes to them. So if we grant this distinction between agents, subjects, and patients, then the idea would be, well, mirroring the distinction between an agent and a subject is a distinction between what we might call praise and respect. So there's a certain kind of respect, a certain kind of moral respect, actually, that animals are sort of owed if they turn out to be moral subjects. And the way I like to think of this is on the sort of lines of aesthetic respect. I used to have a wolf, where you sold him as a wolf. He was in all likelihood a wolf-dog mix. But he had certain idiosyncrasies which involved basically eating all my possessions or anything he could lay his jaws on. So I had to run with him all the time, you know, and I became quite good at running, but, you know... he was in a different league, you know. You'd sort of look at this animal, and from a distance, it looked like he was just floating an inch above the ground. And I always wanted to be able to run with it. And I suppose, an aesthetic realization, you know, that it's a good thing that the world contains something which can move like that. It's a good thing aesthetically speaking, even though he has no control over the way he moves. He's a wolf. He's going to do what he does, you know. So I think I tend to think of moral respect on along the lines of aesthetic respect. When you have something that's doing something that's good, for example, then it is a good thing that the world...
Well, Mark, does we really need to go that far? I mean, maybe it's just an empirical conceptual question for you whether they are moral subjects, but even if they weren't moral, they're still cool and beautiful and part of this intricate design of the web of life on Earth. And I am always awestruck by that. And I'm awestruck by the just brilliance of natural selection in designing creatures to occupy every conceivable niche. You know, fact that it thought of this sociality thing, right? Because, you know, many animals are very solitary and they don't care at all about their conspecifics. They hardly ever encounter their conspecifics except to mate. And then they go their separate ways. But nature said, well, let's make cohort forming animals, and then it designed them to keep these cohorts intact. I mean, I think that's cool, whether or not it adds up to the morality of animals.
Oh yeah, no, I agree absolutely. There's lots of cool things about animals. I mean, think of it this way. I mean, there's a tendency when people think of animal rights to just think of animals as receptacles of pain or pleasure. Right, so you know, if that were the case, if that's all they were, then treating them well would amount to, you know, eliminating pain as much as possible and enhancing pleasure as much as possible. You know, but you imagine a human being who was raised in that sort of way, then their life would just be, you know, a kind of sad waste. To treat a human well is to sort of recognize that they have lots and lots of different abilities and to allow them to sort of develop and enhance their abilities as much as possible. I think the same is true of animals. They have a capacity for acting morally, and this is one of the things that it would be a good thing if it were developed and so on. And so there's a certain kind of respect, I think, that's based on this ability, which isn't there if they're simply receptacles of pain and pleasure.
Okay, so we've got email from Lou in San Francisco that I think develops this idea. She says, even if we already think that we shouldn't mistreat animals because they can feel pain, if we admit that they act morally, do we have to treat them better than creatures that are not moral but can nevertheless feel pain? Does calling them moral subjects elevate their moral status? So you've been talking about that, but here's a chance to elaborate a little more on that.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. There's a certain difference in attitude. I mean, if we have an animal that's simply capable of feeling pleasure and pain, and nothing else, then treating them well involves a certain type of treatment. But an animal which is capable of sort of acting well or badly in a moral sense, the type of treatment that's required is quite different. And so, you know, when you, for example, you have a dog who's been trained to fight, this is harming the dog in ways that are quite different and not reducible to simply questions about the amount of pain or pleasure in its life.
Now you sound kind of Aristotelian. It's like the dog.
I have my moments.
The dog. It's like the dog has what Aristotle would call a telos, an end at which it aims, and its end. You might think its end is life as a moral animal, and if we train the dog to be a killer, we're deflecting it from its telos, and that's a kind of harm to the dog. It's not just a bad thing to do, but it's a harm to the dog because, you know,
in the sense that it would be a harm to a human being if we were to do that to them.
Well, yeah, because
a human being, trained killer.
Yeah, but the human beings are in a completely different category. Some might think.
Well, that's the question, though, isn't it? Really, I mean, if diverting or diverting someone's moral sentiments in a sort of bad way, if we do that to a human being, then we're doing a certain type of harm to them. Which is not reducible to inflicting pain or pleasure or anything like that.
Right.
It's a different type of harm.
I think that's a good and deep point. On KALW, our home station, there was a show before we were on that concerned Japanese soldiers who were trained to be ruthless killers of Chinese. And they described the training they went through, which was really, in your sense, to drain them of any sense of moral agency and to undermine their status as moral subjects. And I think our feeling was that this was clearly a very bad thing for the Chinese villagers that got ruthlessly killed and bayoneted. But it was also really a despicable thing to do to young boys. Of course, we do less dramatic things over the world.
You're right, that was a powerful thing. But part of the badness of that showed up in the soldiers in their late lives, later regret, their deep regret. But here's a question for you. See, here's the big thing about moral agents, which I'm not sure about moral subjects. There's lots of questions here, but one is, you know, we can have moral community with our fellow moral agents. We could have a kind of moral respect for the animals, but we're not really part of their... I mean, we're not on the same moral terms as they are in their moral communities. The wolf packs, they don't care about us. They don't care what we think about them. I mean, we can get in their way, but they don't engage in kind of moral deliberation from us. And if you think morality is this thing that is a tool between us for moral deliberation and social cohesion among us, I mean, are the animals really part of us? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I suppose the question then is, well, is that all morality is? I mean, first of all, the sort of separation of us and animals doesn't really work anymore because, you know, you both have dogs, you know. So they're part of our community in I think, a very sort of clear sense.
They've clearly co-evolved.
And that's certainly true. And moreover, every animal on the earth has been affected, mostly for worse, by our despoiling of the environment, destruction of their habitats. So that's true. We have done a lot of harm to them. But I don't know if that makes us an immoral community with them in a certain way.
No, I think Will Kimlicker and Sue Donaldson have an interesting sort of line on this. And they basically distinguish citizens, and your pet dogs would be citizens in their sense, from denizens, creatures which share the same kind of space as us. Squirrels, crows, things
cats.
Like that. Cats. Well, that could go either way with cats. Yeah, and then sort of wild creatures in the sort of standard sense, which would be regarded as citizens of a sovereign nation,
right.
Sort of thing. A different sorry. So there are all sorts of wrinkles and issues.
What about this? So one of our emailers said, "Oh, humans have done more death and destruction, but you know, if my dog Taffy could be let loose in the squirrel kingdom, she would ravage and pillage it. She has no sympathy for squirrels. She's really cool with other dogs. She despises cats. I don't know what she'd do with mice. I mean, what about that? Should I regard her as evil for her attitude toward the poor defenseless squirrel?"
Well, you can't regard her as evil, at least in the way I look at it, because she's not a moral agent, so she can't be evaluated for what she does. Could you regard this as a bad thing? Yes, something to be regretted, I suppose. But there are sort of, I suppose, issues about. I'll just stick with that. I think it's something what we don't want to do is say when the wolf preys on the caribou, it's doing something morally wrong, because I think clearly in that case it's not. The suffering of the caribou for the wolf is not a morally salient feature of the situation, and morality in the kind of sentimentalist tradition that I sort of inhabit is a matter of being able to emotionally detect certain morally salient features of the situation. So the suffering of the caribou is not for the wolf a morally salient feature. I think that's right. The suffering of squirrels for your in the case of your dog, it's tricky because we have you know a dog which is woven into human society, interacting with something which occupies the same kind of space, but is not really woven into society in the same way. So I'd simply say it's something to be regretted and hopefully avoided.
Well, the most people wouldn't be unhappy if their dog killed a rat, but they are unhappy right. If a dog kills a squirrel. Squirrel's just a rat, as far as I can tell, with a furry tail. So what does that tell us about human beings? We like furry tails, even though we don't have them. Well, I guess that's pretty noble.
Mark, you have a brief closing thought, for us?
A very brief closing thought? No, not really, not at all.
Okay,
that was fun.
That absence of brief thought, I'm going to thank you for joining us, Mark. It's been a very fascinating
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Mark.
Our guest has been Mark Rowlands, professor of philosophy at the University of Miami, author of Can Animals Be Moral? This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow our tweets on Twitter, our very extensive tweet, and you can find out more by visiting our extraordinarily active and ever-growing Facebook page.
Now, let's hear from the high-speed animal magnetism of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, our relationship with animals has always been somewhat fraught. Is it okay to eat them? Well, which ones? Is it okay for circuses to have elephants? Are pit bulls evil, or is it just their owners? Why do we have cats, anyway? As for animals displaying moral behavior, well, maybe they do, but it's probably not the same morality as the one we hold in our pointy little heads. I had a cat, for instance, that used to bring me presents, a half-eaten mouse or a garter snake, not quite dead. He'd drop it at my feet and look pleased with himself. Was he sharing with me, though? Did he want to be seen as a brave hunter? Why would a cat care what I think about his hunting abilities? He certainly didn't care about my attention in other ways. Coming when I called cutely, for example, he couldn't be bothered. Did he stop scratching the couch when I yelled at him? No, he didn't care. Why are we so obsessed with animal behaviors, and why do we insist on filtering their behaviors through human lenses? We think of owls as wise. Why? Crows and seagulls both seem smarter than owls. Why do some people love yappy little lap dogs, and others go for enormous hairy dogs that drool on your shoes? I don't know. Are dolphins really that smart? Why are cartoon characters so often animals? Do we blame Aesop for that? Before cartoons, we had Chicken Little, Puss in Boots, the trickster coyote, the fox in the henhouse, the scorpion, and the frog. And they evolve over time. Ka the Python is Mowgli's friend in The Jungle Book, but his enemy in the movie. And he's voiced by Sterling Holloway, who also did the voice of Winnie the Pooh. What does that tell us? Goofy can talk, Pluto can't. What does that tell us? Are animals ruthless communists like in Animal Farm, or Homeric heroes like in Watership Down? Why does Tony the Tiger make us want to eat cornflakes? Did you know that Elsie Borden and Elmer the Bull were married? Whose idea was Joe Camel anyway? And what's up with the cartoon bear that sounds like Bing Crosby and the stork that sounds like Groucho Marx? Do people even know who they are anymore? We thought it was cute when Charlie the Tuna wanted to be put in a can and eaten. Is it the same thing with the puppet chickens and the Foster Farms commercials? Walt Disney built a billion-dollar empire on the basis of displaying the wiggly, fuzzy butts of ducks. But whatever happened to Ludwig von Drake? Whatever happened to voice actors like Mel Blanc and Dawes Butler? Now it's movie stars who get all the voice work. And the donkey doesn't sound like a donkey anymore. It sounds like Eddie Murphy. Why do all the animals in Hanna-Barbera cartoons have pork pie hats and neckties? America wants to know. If Timmy's in the well, do you send Lassie back to the ranch for help, or do you put the camera down, go to the well yourself, and throw the kid a rope? That's right. Give Lassie a pat on the head, a treat. Have her lie down for a bit in the shade. She's a good old dog. Could probably use a break. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and of the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Our director of marketing is Dave Millar. Gorilla Kreitmar is our performance consultant.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Jimmy Tobin, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Oh! A deer!
A female deer.